And that is for a scalar. So let's just look at df by dx mu, but not as the geometric operator d by dx mu acting on f for a particular mu, but rather as the components of a covector. So when I talked about bases, I talked about a coordinate basis for covectors, and I kind of wrote down this dx mu, which is really just talking about, if you like, the gradient operator. So think of this as the gradient in your sort of regular Cartesian vector calculus. So this, if we, you know, there I'm just writing it schematically, but we define it. There's a map from this D is a map from functions to covectors, such that at any P, if I take the covector df, so this is defining my d, and I act on a vector with it, so df of t is tf. So remember that vectors are maps from functions to functions, and so here our df is a covector, which is a map from vectors to and up to the real, so in other words, giving you like a function. And this has to be true for all t in tp of m at p and any f in c infinity of m. So that tells you what, that's sort of defining this operation for you. And it's just saying that it really is taking a sort of gradient. So I can sort of sketch. I think when I was asked on Monday, how do you visualize, you know, like covectors? This was, I sort of said something like this. If these surfaces here are f as constant, then I can think, it's a bit dodgy, but I can think of df as sort of being normal to the surfaces. So I call that one sigma. So what do I mean by normal to surfaces? Because I haven't got a metric, right? Well, if I take a curve, gamma, so gamma lies entirely in sigma, so it just lies in one of these f equals constant surfaces, then df contracted with t, the tangent to gamma, is tf, which is zero because f is constant along gamma because it's constant on sigma. So that's what I mean by air quotes normal. Okay? So this is a way of thinking about the exterior derivative or d of the function. And it really is just like a gradient. Grad f in normal Cartesian vector calculus is normal to surfaces of constant f. So that is the sort of most elementary way of defining this exterior derivative. But of course, this only acts on scalars, and we want to act on, you know, full-blooded geometric objects. So now I need to decide what geometric objects it's going to act on, and this is where we get into forms. So a form is a completely anti-symmetric covariant tensor. And so we usually call it a P form, which means it's a P rank P covariant tensor, which means it's got P downstairs indices in essence. So we build up these P forms like we build up tensor product spaces. We start with taking two covectors. So our covector there is a one form. So we build up an anti-symmetric product. This is how we construct these P forms. So if A and B are in the dual space, and I don't really need TP of M, but just in the dual bundle, then I define a wedge product as A tensor B minus B tensor A. That's how I start. And then I could do A tensor B tensor C, et cetera, and take all the odd and even permutations, weighting them with the sign of the permutation. So that is how we define this wedge product. It is anti-symmetrized tensor product. And then our space, this gives us a two form. And then just like with the tensor product, we build that up from taking two vectors, and that gives us something with two legs, and then we take the space spanned by things that are of that form, which gives us our rank two tensors. It's the same sort of idea here. So in general, I'm going to just give it in components. Just because it's a bit easier. My wedge product if you want the components of the wedge product of two forms, you essentially just, this is being recorded. I was going to use a quote from The Martian, but I won't because it's being recorded. So those of you who watched that know what I was going to say. You anti-symmetrize the you-know-what out of it. So. So that is how we build up these completely anti-symmetric forms. Now this wedge product, sort of defined it here both by just doing one forms and then telling you how it works if I'm just getting two general rank forms, wedging them together. But we write, we can sort of use, we use this wedge to encode this anti-symmetry. It's either with or without the brackets. So it's just denoted like with that wedge, P, telling you the rank of the form. So it's lambda P of M. So it's sort of obvious if you think about it, that P has to be less than or equal to N because you're anti-symmetrizing. So you're in an n-dimensional manifold, so there's only n linearly independent directions. So if you try to anti-symmetrize over n plus one directions, you will get zero, because you can always write the n plus oneth object as a linear combination of the other n linearly independent objects. And another way of visualizing these, so for example, so this is in essence A, wedge A is always zero. And I think the thing that I like to keep in mind when doing some of these geometric operations or some of these definitions, it's actually quite useful to go back to standard Cartesian vectors, normal 3D Cartesian vectors. So here, think about it as the cross product, except for the cross product, here you have an A and a B. I should do it the other way, shouldn't I? If A and B are not the same, then you can think of A wedge B as like a little tile, a parallelogram that's spanned by A and B. That's one way of thinking about it. And so as B and A come into alignment, the area of that little tile goes to zero. Now in three dimensions, if you do this two form, you know that there's always one other direction, right? And so that's what you do for the cross product. You take the orthogonal direction. But in more than three dimensions, you don't have that. And so you stick with the anti-symmetric two form. So this N form, is actually unique up to a factor. So we have, in at least in four dimensions, that are epsilon tensors. So again, you meet this back in sort of undergraduate or before Cartesian vectors. You have the epsilon. You have three indices there. And it's defined as the sine of the permutation of A, B, C, and D of 0, 1, 2, 3. So epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is plus 1. Epsilon 1, 0, 2, 3 is minus 1. So strictly speaking, this epsilon object is actually not a tensor, but a tensor density. What do we mean by that? Well, again, going back to that sort of 19th century indices type of notation and thinking about the action of coordinate transformations on an object, then my epsilon, which would be 1 over n factorial, epsilon mu 1 mu n dx mu 1 dx mu n. If I do a coordinate transformation, then this is actually the definition of the determinant. So if you want to find the determinant of a general dimensional matrix, what you do is you contract it with the epsilon tensor. I hope that's... So if I transform from the x coordinates to the x prime coordinates, then my epsilon components transform with the determinant of the coordinate transformation. And so this is what defines a tensor density, and this would be called the weight. So it's sort of covariant, almost covariant, but not quite. You get this extra sort of factor. Now, if, yeah?
Sorry, when you're doing a coordinate transformation, you get a factor of the, like, dx, dx. You chop the...
Sorry. Thank you very much. I think... No, you're absolutely right. I think we're probably all a little bit tired. And I, apart from the person who's just arrived, I think I'm more tired than most of you. So you are absolutely spot on. Right. So, I mean, here, the reason this comes up is because you're replacing these things by dx primed, dx primed. So that's where it comes from. Okay. So, I mean, actually, this is correct. But what happens is this is the intermediate step, right? So here, this would be dx mu by dx prime mu prime, dx prime mu prime. And then you pick one up for every single basis form. And then what you've got is epsilon mu 1 to mu n times this coordinate transformation matrix. But the definition of a determinant is that epsilon times, so let me just put it in two, let's do it with two indices. So det of, to get the determinant of a 2x2 matrix, you have that, I'm probably going to unravel here because I'm trying to do this on the hoof when I'm completely jet lagged. So if I use the epsilon tensor, epsilon AB, and let's say I've got a matrix MAC, MBD, that equals det M epsilon CD. Okay? And that's true. That's how you define the determinant of a matrix in sort of arbitrary dimensions. So that's where this comes, because you first of all do dx by dx prime, and then you collect all your dx by dx primes together. You see that they're being contracted with an epsilon, and that tells you it's det times mu epsilon.
Wait, I'm not sure I entirely understand this notation here. I don't quite understand. How is M defined and the determinant of it doesn't have any indices, but then...
Sorry?
I'm not quite sure I understand the notation here.
So here, this was just trying to make a remark in case you haven't seen the definition. So when you take the determinant here, this is just a matrix. Forget for the moment about, you know, the geometry part of it. This is a matrix, M, okay? And then you're taking this epsilon tensor, so this is plus 1, you know, epsilon 1, 2 is 1, and it's epsilon 2, 1 is minus 1. So you contract your matrix with this, and that is equal to, this is what defines a determinant the determinant of the matrix, right? I'm just saying this is det M, right?
Contracting two copies of the matrix.
Yeah, two copies of the matrix. So that is det M times epsilon CD.
Oh, the determinants, because we had like the, oh.
Yeah, I recommend you just literally, because it's only two dimensions, you can do it very quickly and you can verify that that is indeed the right, you know, gives you M11, M22 minus M12, M21. Okay? And so in already by the time you get to three dimensions, you know, you're having to think to do a determinant about, now hang on, wait a minute, I have to change it when I do the one in the middle and so on and so forth. And as you step up in dimensions, you know, the determinant of an n by n matrix is you start, you know, along the top row, you block out the column in the row of that entry, and then take the determinant of the n minus 1 by n minus 1 matrix. And then you, as you hop along, you flip the sign each time. That's just what this does.
So for this one, what we end up with on the right-hand side is that in and of itself a matrix, because that Levi-Civita tensor, whatever it is, would be like...
It's a 2x2.
Okay.
The epsilon AB is a 2x2 matrix. Just literally, I suggest you just do it, you know, because it's, as I say, it's the end of a long day, I think. So I don't think we're going to necessarily easily see things quickly in our heads. So just make a note and literally fill in 1, 2, 2, 1, or draw it, you know, as a 2x2 matrix. Here, of course, upstairs in three, you know, in a flat two dimensions, upstairs and downstairs doesn't really matter, right? Because it's all the same. So what this means, though, is that if we have a metric, we can make epsilon covariant. So just to see how to do this, note that G, if you think of G as a set of components, then as it's a matrix, right? It's an n by n matrix. So what happens under a coordinate transformation . The components change covariantly under a coordinate transformation. And so instead of my det G primed is now det of a sort of product and contraction of three matrices. And so this is equal to det G times det of dx by dx primed squared, because I get one for each of these. So when I look at what happens over here, and I'm sort of getting this determinant of the coordinate transformation, if I multiply by the root of G, then this whole thing is covariant. So here, det G prime is det G times det dx dx prime squared. So therefore, det G is det G prime divided by that squared. Is that a hand? Sorry, at the back. You want to ask a question?
Actually, after the tense, what is the letter? Kes? Just send us the hero.
The last line that you wrote is like
it looks like
epsilon.
A epsilon.
It's an epsilon.
It's also an epsilon.
The curly epsilon?
Yeah.
Oh, this one, yeah. I'm trying to do, when you handwrite, it's not easy to do different fonts. So that is.
What represents, what it denotes.
Oh, so what I'm trying to do is to build a covariant object, a tensor, and I can only do that if I have a metric. So in essence, over there, I said to think of the wedge product as being like the cross product. So here, you've got this interpretation of the wedge product as corresponding to area. But we only have a notion of area if we have a notion of distance, because it gives us a notion of size, okay? So once we have a notion of size, we can assign something, a geometric meaning to this thing in a very sort of direct physical way. So with our notion of distance, I can now say that my epsilon, you know, which is dx cross dy cross dz, so I think of the basis vectors. Here's my dx. I cross it with dy, and then I cross it with dz. And to be sure, I don't have to have, I can always draw this box as a coordinate box, but it doesn't mean anything in the manifold unless I have a notion of distance in the manifold. And once I have that notion of distance in the manifold, I have a volume in the manifold. And that volume, if I think of this box now as being something that's, well, here I've drawn it straight in the underlying Rn, but, you know, I can think infinitesimally of some small sort of infinitesimal deformed cube in my manifold. But as soon as I have a volume, that's actually something physical. And once I've got something physical, I mean that, you know, that sort of saying is geometric from the mathematical side. And so then I expect it to be represented by something covariant. And so this thing here is what we would associate with a volume. It's telling us about the volume locally of space.
I think still the sign of the tensor can be flipped.
It is convention dependent. So here, so again, good point. So typically, I will choose like this non var epsilon, 1, 2, 3 is equal to +1. But you could choose it the other way. And it is totally legitimate choice. It's just, you'll get a few, you know, you'll have relatively minor signs, but it's not important. Yeah.
And how do you do it if the manifold is non-orientable?
So I guess you can still do it locally, right? So you can always define these things locally, but then I guess you wouldn't have a global covering. Because I mean, even the Möbius strip, right? If you make one, still has, you can still look at the area on it, right? And that still means something, but you don't know which side you're on. Good point. Not too sure how the mathematical answer for that is.
If you have a non-orientable manifold, would you have global, well-defined metric, because the signature of the metric.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, because you would have then you wouldn't have a parity operator, right? You wouldn't have a notion of parity. So if you had a non-orientable manifold, so therefore that's kind of quite a fundamental thing in physics. So I don't know the mathematical answer to that. I mean, I think I'm going to cop out and say I'm jet lagged and we have orientability in physics. But it's a really good question. Yeah.
I asked Aldo in the tutorial, and like he told me the same, that about the area still makes sense.
Yeah.
But I understand that the area, like counting, like, I don't know, you can just cut the strip and count the area, but I don't understand how you build the area as an integral.
I think what I'm about to say won't go through if it's non-orientable, because here it's the same area whether you look at it from above or below. But when we do a cross product, we always have our third, you know, our third orthogonal vector, and that you couldn't do, yeah? Ask a mathematician. So what I'm about to say is essentially sort of linking to this notion of the cross product, and saying that once we have this epsilon tensor, we can actually now map across different rank of wedge product spaces. So this introduces this star operator where lambda p maps to lambda n minus p, obviously of m being understood. And we write that a goes to star a. So this a is a p form and star a is an n minus p form. And again, I'm going to step back to components. So what you do is you take the epsilon tensor, and you kind of mop up the indices of the form, and that leaves you with n minus p indices, and they're all anti-symmetric because of epsilon. And so this is the Hodge dual. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, would you mind going back for just a second again? How did these figure out that far epsilon is the volume form? Like, why is that defined as the volume form?
So I'm saying, I'm drawing that from sort of this picture. I'm building it from this picture over here. It's a way of thinking about what does the cross product do. So if we think about two co-vectors, and as we bring them into alignment, gradually the area of the parallelogram spanned by them, and this is thinking really in flat Rn here, but gradually the area decreases to zero. So it is extending that intuition, if you like, to n dimensions. We have, you know, our basis of forms, and we can think again, just looking down locally, these all go off in linearly independent directions, and it's, if you have infinitesimals, little dx, dy, dz, indeed dx wedge dy wedge dz is giving you a sort of scalar volume.
Why Why would that be connected to the Levi-Civita tensor?
Because that's completely, that's a rank, you know, that is the sort of maximal form that you've got. So,
oh, okay, right.
So I mean, in a sense, what you're sort of doing here is you're saying that you have this dx cross dy cross dz, right? These are now forms, but then you can sort of write that as your epsilon 3 form, yeah, times dx dy dz, where these are sort of, you know, like the magnitude of those infinitesimals, yeah? And then you would, as we will be, this you would then say, well, hang on, I know there's a root g in there. So I would peel off the root g, I would write my d3x, and then I would just sort of forget about the epsilon. And then I would say, this is my volume. Yeah. So you've probably seen that. But really, this is what you're doing. You're in, you know, this really is your measure, if you like. So the reason that it comes from the volume is because the metric gives you a measure on the space. So it gives you a way of evaluating how you integrate. So I think it's all about just trying to develop an intuition for what these things are doing for you. So we've defined what we mean by forms. We've defined the wedge product. We've talked about the epsilon tensor. I've taken a detour through the Hodge dual. And now I'd like to come back to what I said I was going to do in the first place, which is to say, give you the definition of the exterior derivative. Uh-huh, yeah, sorry, just writing that.
Sorry to interpret, I think you were supposed to enter the afternoon.
So. Only after 5, isn't that right, Aldo?
Yeah. Yeah,
I've got 15 minutes on the right. Yeah, no, it's fine. We may just stop, we'll see. I think we're all a little dazed, you know. Okay, so mathematically, you define, again, the exterior derivative as an operator. And just as it takes functions to one forms, it takes p forms to p plus one forms, and it has three properties. So number one, so we have a map, this sort of derivation, going from P forms to P plus one forms. It reduces to D on functions. It is pseudo-Leibnizian. So this is usually when you're trying to define a derivative, it is something which is Leibnizian, which means like operator acting on AB is operator acting on A times B plus A times operator acting on B. Here, D of A wedge B, again, A is a P form, B is a Q form, that is D of A wedge B minus to the power Q, P, sorry, not Q, A wedge DB. So it has a Leibnizian property, But there's just a sort of this sign can creep in because of the anti-symmetry. And then the final property that it has to satisfy is that d squared is zero. So those three requirements actually uniquely define the exterior derivative. Of course, that doesn't help us because we need to do calculations. So what we actually need is just an expression that tells us how to take the exterior derivative. And so what we do is we take the partial derivative of A and again anti-symmetrize the you-know-what out of it. So that is how we take an exterior derivative in practice. So it's completely anti-symmetric. And if you look at what happens under a coordinate transformation, while strictly speaking, you pick up those second derivatives of the coordinate transformation because of the anti-symmetry, they all cancel out. And so this thing is covariant. And again, with the metric, so it takes us from P forms to P minus one forms. And it's defined using the Hodge dual. We first hop from a P form to an N minus P form using the star. Then we take D, so that gets us to N minus P plus one form. And then we dual back again, and that gets us to an N minus P plus one form, which gives us a P minus one form. And what that does here is it takes, if you like, the divergence. So again, note now, this is grad. So we've now, I know we haven't strictly, I haven't talked about the connection, but you see the metric coming in there. So just to sort of link together D and the Lie derivative, or the Lie bracket in this case, this is an identity. If we take D of a one form, D omega, and then contract it with two vectors, so that's what this means, then this is defined as a sort of obvious commutator. So it's U acting on this omega of V, which is a scalar, minus V acting on omega of U, which is a scalar. And then you have to subtract omega acting on the Lie bracket of U and V, and that is V acting on U and V.
Omega is a one form
there. So I typically underline geometric objects and I try and use Greek symbols for forms or covectors and Latin for vectors. So I just want to wrap up by again going over something that you know already, it's familiar. I just want to talk about the covariant derivative or the connection. So that we can proceed on Monday with Cartan structural equations. So really how the covariant derivative works is by finding a way by finding a way of gluing together the tangent spaces. So remember, strictly speaking, when we construct these tangent spaces, they're all just separate planes, if you like, lying above the manifold or sort of grazing the manifold as a tangent space. But they're just completely independent and separate. And if we want to do, you know, derivatives, we have to find a way of linking them together. So the Lie derivative kind of linked them together by running along these integral curves. The connection is just a different way of linking tangent spaces together. So it's really telling us if we have a basis EA of TP of M, it gives us, if you like, a rule of how to relate this to a basis E prime B primed of some nearby tangent space. So that's really what it's doing. And so we have this linkage. So here, grad, which is going to be our covariant derivative. This is a derivation. This is a basis vector. B is a label. So that is what, these are the components of our connection. So these are scalars. This is a vector, basis vector. And this is a basis covector. So it's saying that, you know, you've got a basis. This is a particular element of that basis. And as you move around in the manifold, it transforms into some combination of the basis at the nearby point. But of course, it's a derivation, so it's also, if you like, adding a covector index. Could write So that's just trying to introduce it schematically, but the actual definition is that, you know, this covariant derivative or grad is a derivation that commutes with contractions. That, in other words, if we have omega of v, grad of the scalar omega of v is grad omega of v plus v grad omega. It's also Leibnizian. And guess what? It reduces to D on functions. So let me just talk about what happens to a general vector. So what is grad V? Here is a geometric expression, okay? It is just the derivation acting on a vector. So that is the grad acting on the components of V in a particular basis contracted with the basis. Now, grad commutes with contractions. So this is grad of VA times EA plus VA grad of EA. Now, these Vs are scalars, and grad reduces to D on functions. So this is just D of VA, and this is simply gamma the connection coefficients. So I meant to point out before, we get the green chalk, that notice that this covector here is what's coming from the grad, and it's always the first index on gamma. That's potentially important if the connection is not symmetric. So then, this dVA is just the partial derivative of V, of those scalars, plus gamma. Now I'm going to change the C to an A. And the A to a C. So this here is my abstract index expression.
How come we have two VAs?
Sorry, where? Oh, in the second one. Get rid of it. Okay. Well, I think we've all had enough, so I'm going to stop there. But hopefully that last little piece of writing is sort of highlighting this difference between thinking about geometric notation and our usual abstract index. This is the geometric object. This decomposes it with respect to a basis. We take grad of that basis, and grad sees the components, which are scalars, so they just take partial derivatives, and then it acts on the vector, but that is the very definition of the connection. Now, note here, I haven't actually taken a coordinate basis. I've just been completely agnostic about what my basis is. But you see that what you end up with is that abstract index formula. And so what you'd normally write is grab B, BA is this.
I have questions about the third properties. I think it is equal to saying that the gamma is torsion free.
Sorry? The
equal to saying the BC is symmetric?
No, it's not. This does not mean torsion free.
If we take the curvature ET for the one form, equal to saying that if it is contractive AB indices, then it is a zero. That means gamma should be symmetric for the AB.
Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm following the question, but gamma is definitely does not have to be symmetric from this.
So BC should not be symmetric.
So that was why I made the point about